The north wall features a single entrance, one man-sized door. After moving around to the far side of the van, finding no one there either, I'm indecisive for precious seconds. From a distance of 20 feet, under a moon that seems to conceal as much with its shadows as it reveals with its milky light, I nevertheless can see that the north door is ajar. On some deep level, perhaps I know what I should do, what I must do. But the part of me that keeps secrets so well is insistent that I return to my bed, forget the cry that woke me from a dream of my mother, and sleep the last of the night away. In the morning, of course, I'll have to continue living in the dream that I've made for myself, a prisoner of this life of self-deception, with truth and reality tucked into a forgotten pocket at the back of my mind. Maybe the burden of that pocket has become too heavy for the fabric to contain it, and maybe the threads of the seams have begun to break. On some deep level, maybe I have decided to end my waking dream. Or maybe the choice I make is preordained, having less to do with either my subconscious agonies or my conscience than with the track of destiny on which I've traveled since the day I was born. Maybe choice is an illusion, and maybe the only routes we can take in life are those marked on a map at the moment of our conception. I pray to God that destiny isn't a thing of iron, that it can be flexed and reshaped, that it bends to the power of mercy, honesty, kindness, and virtue, because otherwise I can't tolerate the person I will become, the things I will do, or the end that will be mine. That hot July night, beaded with sweat but chilled, 14 in moonlight, I am thinking about none of that. No brooding about hidden secrets or destiny. That night, I'm driven by emotion rather than intellect, by sheer intuition rather than reason, by need rather than curiosity. I'm only 14 years old, after all, only 14. The barn waits. I go to the door, which is ajar. I listen at the gap between the door and the jamb. Silence within. I push the door inward. The hinges are well oiled, my feet are bare, and I enter with a silence as perfect as that of the darkness that welcomes me. Spencer opened his eyes from the dark interior of the barn in the dream to the dark interior of the rock-pinned explorer, and he realized that night had come to the desert. He had been unconscious for at least 5 or 6 hours. His head was tipped forward, his chin on his chest. He gazed down into his own upturned palms, chalk-white and supplicant. The rat was on the floor. Couldn't see it, but it was there in the darkness, floating. Don't think about that. The rain had stopped, no drumming on the roof. He was thirsty, parched, raspy tongue, chapped lips. The truck rocked slightly. The river was trying to push it over the cliff, the tireless dammed river. No, that couldn't be the explanation. The roar of the waterfall was gone. The night was silent. No thunder, no lightning, no water sounds out there anymore. He ached all over. His head and neck were the worst. He could barely find the strength to look up from his hands. Rocky was gone. The passenger door hung open. The truck rocked again, rattled and creaked. The woman appeared at the bottom of the open door. First her head, then her shoulders, as if she were levitating up out of the flood, except judging by the comparative quiet, the flood was gone. Because his eyes were adapted to darkness and cool moonlight shone between ragged clouds, Spencer was able to recognize her. In a voice as dry as cinders, but without a slur, he said, "Hi." "Hi yourself," she said.
"Come in."
"Thank you, I think I will."
"This is nice," he said.
"You like it here?"
"Better than the other dream."
She levered herself into the truck, and it wobbled more than before, grinding against rock at both ends. The motion disturbed him, not because he was concerned that the truck would shift and break loose and fall, but because it stirred up his vertigo again. He was afraid of spiraling out of this dream back into the nightmare of July and Colorado. Sitting where Rocky had once sat, she remained still for a moment, waiting for the truck to stop moving. "This is one damn tricky situation you've gotten into."
"Ball lightning," he said.
"Excuse me?"
"Ball lightning."
"Of course."
"Knock the truck into the arroyo."
"Why not?" she said. It was so hard to think, to express himself clearly. Thinking hurt, thinking made him dizzy.
"Thought it was aliens," he explained.
"Aliens?"
"Little guys, big eyes, Spielberg."
"Why would you think it was aliens?"
"Because you're wonderful." he said, though the words didn't convey what he meant. In spite of the poor light, he could see that the look she gave him was peculiar. Straining to find better words, made dizzier by the effort, he said,
"Wonderful things must happen around you. Happen around you all the time."
"Oh, yeah, I'm the center of a regular festival."
"You must know some wonderful thing. That's why they're after you, because you know some wonderful thing."
"You've been taking drugs?"
"I could use a couple of aspirin. Anyway, they're not after you because you're a bad person."
"Aren't they?"
"No, because you're not. A bad person, I mean."
She leaned toward him and put a hand against his forehead. Even her light touch made him wince with pain. "How do you know I'm not a bad person?" she asked.
"You were nice to me."
"Maybe it was an act." She produced a penlight from her jacket, peeled back his left eyelid, directed the beam at his eye. The light hurt. Everything hurt. The cool air hurt his face. Pain accelerated his vertigo.
"You were nice to Theta."
"Maybe that was an act, too," she said, now examining his right eye with the penlight.
"Can't fool Theta."
"Why not?"
"She's wise."
"Well, that's true."
"And she makes huge cookies."
Finished examining his eyes, she tipped his head forward to have a look at the gash in the top of his skull. "Nasty. Coagulated now, but it needs cleaned and stitched."
"Ouch!"
"How long were you bleeding?"
"Dreams don't hurt."
"Do you think you lost a lot of blood?"
"This hurts."
"'Cause you're not dreaming." He licked his chapped lips. His tongue was dry.
"Thirsty."
"I'll get you a drink in just a minute," she said, putting two fingers under his chin and tipping his head up again. All this head tipping was making him dangerously dizzy, but he managed to say,
"Not dreaming. Are you sure?"
"Positive." She touched his upturned right palm. "Can you squeeze my hand?"
"Yes."
"Go ahead."
"All right."
"I mean now."
"Oh."
He closed his hand around hers. "That's not bad," she said.
"It's nice."
"A good grip, probably no spinal damage. I expected the worst." She had a warm, strong hand. He said,
"Nice."
He closed his eyes. An inner darkness leapt at him. He opened his eyes at once before he could fall back into the dream. "You can let go of my hand now," she said.
"Not a dream, huh?"
"No dream." She clicked on the penlight again and directed it down between his seat and the center console.
"This is really strange," he said.
She was peering along the narrow shaft of light.
"Not dreaming," he said. "Must be hallucinating."
She popped the release button that disengaged the buckle on his safety harness from the latch between his seat and the console.
"It's okay," he said.
"What's okay?" she asked, switching off the light and returning it to her jacket pocket.
"That you peed on the seat."
She laughed.
"I like to hear you laugh."
She was still laughing as she carefully extricated him from the harness.
"You've never laughed before," he said.
"Well," she said, "not much recently."
"Not ever before. You've never barked either."
She laughed again.
"I'm going to get you a new rawhide bone."
"You're very kind," he said.
"This is damned interesting."
"That's for sure."
"It's so real."
"Seems unreal to me." Even though Spencer remained mostly passive through the process, getting out of the harness left him so dizzy that he saw three of the woman, and three of every shadow in the car, like superimposed images on a photograph. Afraid that he would pass out before he had a chance to express himself, he spoke in a raspy rush of words.
"You're a real friend, pal. You really are. You're a perfect friend."
"We'll see if that's how it turns out."
"You're the only friend I have."
"Okay, my friend. Now we've come to the hard part. How the hell am I going to get you out of this junker when you can't help yourself at all?"
"I can help myself."
"You think you can?"
"I was an Army Ranger once, and a cop."
"Yes, I know."
"I've been trained in Taekwondo."
"That would really be handy if we were under assault by a bunch of ninja assassins, but can you help me get you out of here?"
"A little."
"I guess we've got to give it a try."
"Okay."
"Can you lift your legs out of there, swing them to me?"
"Don't want to disturb the rat."
"There's a rat?"
"He's dead already, but, you know."
"Of course."
"I'm very dizzy."
"Then let's wait a minute. Rest a minute."
"Very, very dizzy."
"Just take it easy."
"Goodbye,"
he said, and surrendered to a black vortex that spun him around and away. For some reason, as he went, He thought of Dorothy and Toto and Oz. The back door of the barn opens into a short hallway. I step inside. No lights, no windows. The green glow from the security system readout, not ready to arm, in the right-hand wall provides just enough light for me to see that I'm alone in the corridor. I don't ease the door all the way shut behind me, but leave it ajar as I found it. The floor appears to be black beneath me, but I'm on polished pine. To the left are a bathroom and a room where art supplies are stored. Those doorways are barely discernible in the faint green wash, which is like the unearthly illumination in a dream, less like real light than like a lingering memory of neon. To the right is a file room. Ahead at the end of the hallway is the door to the large first-floor gallery, where a switchback staircase leads to my father's studio. That upper chamber occupies the entire second floor and features the big north-facing windows under which the van is parked outside. I listen to the hallway darkness. It doesn't speak or breathe. The light switch is to the right, but I leave it untouched. In the green-black gloom, I ease the bathroom door all the way open, step inside, wait for a sound, a sense of movement, a blow. Nothing. The supply room is also deserted. I move to the right side of the hall and quietly open the door to the file room. I step across the threshold. The overhead fluorescent tubes are dark, but there is other light where no light should be, yellow and sour, dim and strange, from a mysterious source at the far end of the room. A long work table occupies the center of that rectangular space. Two chairs, file cabinets, stand against one of the long walls. My heart is knocking so hard it shakes my arms. I make fists of my hands and hold them at my side, struggling to control myself. I decide to return to the house, to bed, to sleep. Then I'm at the far end of the file room, though I can't recall having taken a single step in that direction. I seem to have walked those 20 feet in a sudden spell of sleep, called forward by something, someone, as if responding to a powerful hypnotic command, to a wordless, silent summons. I am standing in front of a knotty pine cabinet that extends from floor to ceiling and from corner to corner of the 13-foot-wide room. The cabinet features three pairs of tall, narrow doors. The center pair stand open. Behind those doors there should be nothing but shelves. On the shelves should be boxes of old tax records, correspondence, and dead files no longer kept in the metal cabinets along the other wall. This night the shelves and their contents, along with the back wall of the pine cabinet, have been pushed backward 4 or 5 feet, into a secret space behind the file room, into a hidden chamber I've never seen before. The sour yellow light comes from a place beyond the closet. Before me is the essence of all boyish fantasies, the secret passage to a world of danger and adventure, to far stars, to stars farther still, to the very center of the earth, to lands of trolls or pirates or intelligent apes or robots, to the distant future or to the age of dinosaurs. Here is a stairway to mystery, a tunnel through which I might set out upon heroic quests, or a way station on a strange highway to dimensions unknown. Briefly, I thrill to the thought of what exotic travels and magical discoveries might lie ahead, but instinct quickly tells me that on the far side of this secret passage there is something stranger and deadlier than an alien world or a Morlock dungeon. I want to return to the house, to my bedroom, to the protection of my sheets, immediately, as fast as I can run. The perverse allure of terror and the unknown deserts me, and I'm suddenly eager to leave this waking dream for the less threatening lands to be found on the dark side of sleep. Although I can't recall crossing the threshold, I find myself inside the tall cabinet instead of hurrying to the house through the night, the moonlight, and the owl shadows. I blink, and then I find that I've gone farther still, not back one step, but forward into the secret space beyond. It's a vestibule of sorts, 6 feet by 6 feet, concrete floor, concrete block walls, bare yellow bulb in a ceiling socket. A cursory investigation reveals that the back wall of the pine cabinet, complete with the attached and laden shelves, is fitted with small concealed wheels. It's been shoved inward on a pair of sliding door tracks. To the right is a door out of the vestibule. An ordinary door, in many ways, heavy, judging by the look of it, solid wood, brass hardware. It's painted white, and in places the paint is yellowed with age. However, though it's more white and grimy yellow than it is anything else, tonight it is neither a white nor a yellow door. A series of bloody handprints arcs from the area around the brass knob across the upper portion of the door, and their bright patterns render the color of the background unimportant. 8, 10, 12 or more impressions of a woman's hands, palms, and spread fingers, each hand partially overlapping the one before it, some smeared, some as clear as police file prints, all glistening, wet, all fresh. Those scarlet images bring to mind the spread wings of a bird leaping into flight, fleeing to the sky in a flutter of fear. Staring at them, I am mesmerized, unable to get my breath, my heart storming, because the handprints convey an unbearable sense of the woman's terror, desperation, and frantic resistance to the prospect of being forced beyond the gray concrete vestibule of this secret world. I can't go forward, can't, won't. I'm just a boy, barefoot, unarmed. Afraid, not ready for the truth. I don't remember moving my right hand, but now it's on the brass knob. I open the red door.
Part 2, To the Source of the Flow. On the road that I have taken, one day walking, I awaken, amazed to see where I have come, where I'm going, where I'm from. This is not the path I thought. This is not the place I sought. This is not the dream I bought. Just a fever of fate I've caught. I'll change highways in a while at the crossroads, one more mile. My path is lit by my own fire. I'm going only where I desire. On the road that I have taken, one day walking, I awaken. One day walking, I awaken on the road that I have taken. The Book of Counted Sorrows. Chapter 11. Friday afternoon, after discussing Spencer Grant's scar with Dr. Mondello, Roy Miro left Los Angeles International aboard an agency Learjet with a glass of properly chilled Robert Mondavi Chardonnay in one hand and a bowl of shelled pistachios in his lap. He was the only passenger, and he expected to be in Las Vegas in an hour. A few minutes short of his destination, his flight was diverted to Flagstaff, Arizona. Flash floods, spawned by the worst storm to batter Nevada in a decade, had inundated lower areas of Las Vegas. Also, lightning had damaged vital electronic systems at the airport, McCarran International, forcing a suspension of service. By the time the jet was on the ground in Flagstaff, the official word was that McCarran would resume operations in 2 hours or less. Roy remained aboard so he would not waste precious minutes returning from the terminal when the pilot learned that McCarran was up and running again. He passed the time, at first, by linking to Mama in Virginia, and using her extensive data bank connections to teach a lesson to Captain Harris Decoteau, the Los Angeles police officer who had irritated him earlier in the day. Decoteau had too little respect for higher authority. Soon, however, in addition to a Caribbean lilt, his voice would have a new note of humility. Later, Roy watched a PBS documentary on one of three television sets that served the passenger compartment of the Lear. The program was about Dr. Jack Kevorkian, dubbed Dr. Death by the media, who had made it his mission in life to assist the terminally ill when they expressed a desire to commit suicide, though he was persecuted by the law for doing so. Roy was enthralled by the documentary. More than once, he was moved to tears. By the middle of the program, he was compelled to lean forward from his chair and place one hand flat on the screen each time Jack Kevorkian appeared in close-up. With his palm against the blessed image of the doctor's face, Roy could feel the purity of the man, a saintly aura, a thrill of spiritual power. In a fair world, in a society based on true justice, Kevorkian would have been left to do his work in peace. Roy was depressed to hear about the man's suffering at the hands of regressive forces. He took solace, however, from the knowledge that the day was swiftly approaching when a man like Kevorkian would never again be treated as a pariah. He would be embraced by a grateful nation and provided with an office, facilities, and salary commensurate with his contribution to a better world. The world was so full of suffering and injustice that anyone who wanted to be assisted in suicide, terminally ill or not, should have that assistance. Roy passionately believed that even those who were chronically but not terminally ill, including many of the elderly, should be granted eternal rest if they wished to have it. Those who didn't see the wisdom of self-elimination should not be abandoned either. They should be given free counseling until they could perceive the immeasurable beauty of the gift that they were being offered. Hand to the screen. Kevorkian in close-up. Feel the power. The day would come when the disabled would suffer no more pain or indignities, no more wheelchairs or leg braces, no more seeing eye dogs, no more hearing aids, prosthetic limbs, no more grueling sessions with speech therapists, only the peace of endless sleep. Dr. Jack Kevorkian's face filled the screen, smiling. Oh, that smile. Roy put both hands to the warm glass. He opened his heart and permitted that fabulous smile to flow into him. He unchained his soul and allowed Kevorkian's spiritual power to lift him up. Eventually, the science of genetic engineering would ensure that none but healthy children were born, and eventually they would all be beautiful, as well as strong and sound. They would be perfect. Until that day came, however, Roy saw a need for an assisted suicide program for infants born with less than the full use of their five senses and all four limbs. He was even ahead of Kevorkian on this. In fact, when his hard work with the agency was done, when the country had the compassionate government that it deserved and was on the threshold of utopia, he would like to spend the rest of his life serving in a suicide assistance program for infants. He could not imagine anything more rewarding than holding a defective baby in his arms while a lethal injection was administered, comforting the child as it passed from imperfect flesh to a transcendent spiritual plane. His heart swelled with love for those less fortunate than he, the halt and blind, the maimed and the ill, and the elderly, and the depressed, and the learning impaired. After 2 hours on the ground in Flagstaff, by the time McCarran reopened and the Learjet departed for a second try at Las Vegas, the documentary had ended. Kevorkian's smile was no longer to be seen. Nevertheless, Roy remained in a state of rapture that he was sure would last for at least several days. The power was now in him. He would experience no more failure, no more setbacks. In flight, he received a telephone call from the agent seeking Ethel and George Porth, the grandparents who had raised Spencer Grant after the death of his mother. According to county property records, the Porths had once owned the house at the San Francisco address in Grant's military records, but they had sold it 10 years ago. The buyers had resold it 7 years thereafter, and the new owners, in residence just 3 years, had never heard of the Porths and had no clue as to their whereabouts. The agent was continuing the search. Roy had every confidence that they would find the Porths. The tide had turned in their favor. Feel the power. By the time the Learjet landed in Las Vegas, night had fallen. Although the sky was overcast, the rain had stopped. Roy was met at the debarkation gate by a driver who looked like a spam loaf in a suit. He said only that his name was Proc and that the car was in front of the terminal. Glowering, he stalked away, expecting to be followed, clearly uninterested in small talk, as rude as the most arrogant maitre d' in New York City. Roy decided to be amused rather than insulted. The nondescript Chevrolet was parked illegally in the load waiting. Dubois, the evening duty officer, was a tall, lanky Texan with mud-brown eyes and hair the color of range dust, on whom clothes hung like thrift shop castaways on a stick and straw scarecrow. Although big-boned, rough-hewn, with a mottled complexion, with jug-handle ears, with teeth as crooked as the tombstones in a cowtown cemetery, with not a single feature that even the kindest critic could deem perfect, Dubois had a good old boy charm and an easy manner that distracted attention from the fact he was a biological tragedy. Sometimes Roy was surprised that he could be around Dubois for long periods, yet resist the urge to commit a mercy killing. "That boy, he's some cute son of a bitch, the way he drove out of that roadblock and into the amusement park," Dubois said as he led Roy down the hall from his office to the satellite surveillance room. "And that dog of his just bobbing his head up and down, like one of them spring-neck novelties that people put on the rear window shelves in their cars. That dog, he got palsy or what?" "I don't know," Roy said. "My grandpap, he once had a dog with palsy. Name was Scooter, but we called him Boomer because he could cut the god-awfulest loud farts. I'm talking about the dog, you understand, not my grandpap." "Of course," Roy said, as they reached the door at the end of the hall. "Boomer got palsied his last year," Dubois said, hesitating with his hand on the doorknob. "Course, he was older than dirt by then, so it wasn't any surprise. Oh, you should have seen that poor hound shake, palsied up something fierce. Let me tell you, Roy, when old Boomer lifted a hind leg and let go with his stream all palsied like he was, you died for cover or wished you was in another county." "Sounds like someone should have put him to sleep," Roy said, as Dubois opened the door. The Texan followed Roy into the satellite surveillance center.
"Nah, Boomer was a good old dog. If the tables had been turned, that old hound wouldn't never have taken a gun and put Grandpap to sleep."
Roy really was in a good mood. He could have listened to Bobby Dubois for hours. The satellite surveillance center was 40 feet by 60 feet. Only two of the 12 computer workstations in the middle of the room were manned, both by women wearing headsets and murmuring into mouthpieces as they studied the data streaming across their VDTs. A third technician was working at a light table, examining several large photographic negatives through a magnifying glass. One of the two longer walls was largely occupied by an immense screen on which was projected a map of the world. Cloud formations were superimposed on it, along with green lettering that indicated weather conditions planet-wide. Red, blue, white, yellow, and green lights blinked steadily, revealing the current positions of scores of satellites. Many were electronic communications packages handling microwave relays of telephone, television, and radio signals. Others were engaged in topographical mapping, oil exploration, meteorology, astronomy, international espionage, and domestic surveillance, among numerous other tasks. The owners of those satellites ranged from public corporations to government agencies and military services. Some were the property of nations other than the United States or of businesses based beyond U.S. shores. Regardless of the ownership or origin, however, every satellite on that wall display could be accessed and used by the agency, and the legitimate operators usually remained unaware that their systems had been invaded. At a U-shaped control console in front of the huge screen, Bobby Dubois said, "The son of a bitch rode straight out of Spaceport Vegas off into the desert, and our boys weren't equipped to chase around playing Lawrence of Arabia." "Did you put up a chopper to track him?" "Weather turned bad too fast. A real toad drowned. A rain coming down like every angel in heaven was taking a leak at the same time." Dubois pushed a button on the console, and the map of the world faded from the wall. An actual satellite view of Oregon, Idaho, California, and Nevada appeared in its place. Seen from orbit, the boundaries of those four states would have been difficult to define, so borders were overlaid in orange lines. Western and southern Oregon, southern Idaho, northern through central California, and all of Nevada were concealed below a dense layer of clouds. "This here's a direct satellite feed. There's just a 3-minute delay for transmission and then conversion of the digital code back into images again," said Dubois. Along eastern Nevada and eastern Idaho, soft pulses of light rippled through the clouds. Roy knew that he was seeing lightning from above the storm. It was strangely beautiful. "Right now, the only storm activity is out on the eastern edge of the front. Except for an isolated patch of spit-thin rain here and there, things are pretty quiet all the way back to the ass end of Oregon. But we can't just do a look down for the son of a bitch, not even with infrared. Be like trying to see the bottom of a soup bowl through clam chowder."
"How long until clear skies?" Roy asked.
"There's a kick-ass wind at high altitudes pushing the fronts east-southeast, so we should have a clear look at the whole Mojave and surrounding territory before dawn."
A surveillance subject sitting in bright sunshine and reading a newspaper could be filmed from a satellite with sufficiently high resolution that the headlines on his paper would be legible. However, in clear weather in an unpopulated wasteland that boasted no animals as large as a man, locating and identifying a moving object as large as a Ford Explorer would not be easy, because the territory to be examined was so vast. Nevertheless, it could be done. Roy said he could leave the desert for one highway or another, put the pedal to the metal, and be long gone by morning.
"Damn few paved roads in this part of the state. We got lookout teams in every direction on every serious highway and sorry strip of blacktop. Interstate 15, Federal Highway 95, Federal Highway 93, plus State Routes 146, 156, 158, 160, 168, and 169. Looking for a green Ford Explorer with some body damage fore and aft. Looking for a man with a dog in any vehicle. Looking for a man with a big facial scar. Hell, we got this whole part of the state locked down tighter than a mosquito's butt."
"Unless you already got off the desert and back onto a highway before you put your men in place."
"Oh, we move quick. Anyway, in a storm as bad as this one, going overland, he made piss-poor time. In fact is, he's damn lucky if he didn't bog down somewhere, four-wheel drive or no four-wheel drive. We'll nail the son of a bitch tomorrow."
"I hope you're right," Roy said.
"I bet my pecker on it."
And they say Las Vegas locals aren't big gamblers.
"How's he tied up with the woman, anyway?"
"I wish I knew," Roy said, watching as lightning flowered softly under the clouds on the leading edge of the storm front. "What about this tape of the conversation between Grant and the old woman?"
"You want to hear that?"
"Yes."
"It starts from where he first says the name Hannah Rainey."
"Let's give it a listen," Roy said, turning away from the wall display. All the way down the hall, into the elevator, and down to the deepest subterranean level of the building, Dubois talked about the best places to get good chili in Vegas, as though he had reason to believe that Roy cared.
There's this joint on Paradise Road. The chili's so hot, some folks have been known to spontaneously combust from eating it. Whoosh! They just go up like torches.
The lift reached the sub-basement.
We're talking chili that makes you sweat from your fingernails, makes your belly button pop out like a meat thermometer.
The doors slid open. Roy stepped into a windowless concrete room. Along the far wall were scores of recording machines. In the middle of the room, rising from a computer workstation, was the most stunningly gorgeous woman Roy had ever seen. Blonde and green-eyed, so beautiful that she took his breath away, so beautiful that she set his heart to racing and sent his blood pressure soaring high into the stroke risk zone, so achingly beautiful that no words could adequately describe her, nor could any music ever written be sweet enough to celebrate her, so beautiful and so incomparable that he couldn't breathe or speak, so radiant that she blinded him to the dreariness of that bunker and left him surrounded by her magnificent light. The flood had disappeared over the cliff like bathwater down a tub drain. The arroyo was now merely an enormous ditch. To a considerable depth, the soil was mostly sand, extremely porous, so the rain had not puddled on it. The downpour had filtered quickly into a deep aquifer. The surface had dried out and firmed up almost as rapidly as the empty channel had previously turned into a racing, spumous river. Nevertheless, before she had risked taking the Range Rover into the channel, although the machine was as sure-footed as a tank, she had walked the route from the eroded arroyo wall to the Explorer and checked the condition of the ground. Satisfied that the bed of the Ghost River wasn't muddy or soft and that it would provide sufficient traction, she had driven the Rover into that declivity and had backed between the two columns of rock to the suspended Explorer. Even now, after rescuing the dog and putting him in the back of the Rover, and after disentangling Grant from his safety harness, she was amazed by the precarious position in which the Explorer had come to rest. She was tempted to lean past the unconscious man and look through the gaping hole where the side window had been, but even if she could have seen much in the darkness, she knew that she wouldn't enjoy the view. The flood tide had lifted the truck more than 10 feet above the floor of the arroyo before wedging it in that pincer of stone on the brink of the cliff. Now that the river had vanished beneath it, the Explorer hung up there, its four wheels in midair, as though gripped in a pair of tweezers that belonged to a giant. When she'd first seen it, she'd stood in childlike wonder, mouth open and eyes wide. She was no less astonished than she would have been if she'd seen a flying saucer and its unearthly crew. She'd been certain that Grant had been swept out of the truck and carried to his death, or that he was dead inside. To get up to his truck, she'd had to back her Rover under it, putting the rear wheels uncomfortably close to the edge of the cliff. Then she had stood on the roof, which brought her head just to the bottom of the Explorer's front passenger door. She had reached up to the handle and, in spite of the awkward angle, had managed to open the door. Water poured out, but the dog was what startled her. Whimpering and miserable, huddled on the passenger seat, he had peered down at her with a mixture of alarm and yearning. She didn't want him jumping onto the Rover. He might slip on that smooth surface and fracture a leg or tumble and break his neck. Although the pooch hadn't looked as if he would perform any canine stunts, she had warned him to stay where he was. She climbed down from the Rover, drove it forward 5 yards, turned it around to direct the headlights on the ground under the Explorer, got out again, and coaxed the dog to jump to the sandy riverbed. He needed a lot of coaxing. Poised on the edge of the seat, he repeatedly built up the courage to jump, but each time he turned his head away at the last moment and shrank back, as if he were facing a chasm instead of a 10 or 12 foot drop. Finally, she remembered how Theda Davidowitz had often talked to Sparkle, and she tried the same approach with this dog.
"Come on, sweetums, come to Mama, come on, little sweetums, little pretty-eyed snooky-wookums."
In the truck above, the pooch pricked one ear and regarded her with acute interest.
"Come here, come on, Snookums, little sweetums."
He began to quiver with excitement.
"Come to Mama, come on, little pretty eyes."
The dog crouched on the seat, muscles tensed, poised to leap.
"Come give Mama a kissy, little cutie baby."
She felt idiotic, but the dog jumped. He sprang out of the open door of the Explorer, sailed in a long, graceful arc through the night air, and landed on all fours. He was so startled by his own agility and bravery that he turned to look up at the truck and then sat down as if in shock. He flopped onto his side, breathing hard. She had to carry him to the rover and lay him in the cargo area directly behind the front seat. He repeatedly rolled his eyes at her, and he licked her hand once. "You're a strange one," she said, and the dog sighed. Then she had turned the rover around again, backed it under the suspended explorer, and climbed up to find Spencer Grant slumped behind the steering wheel, woozily conscious. Now he was out cold again. He was murmuring to someone in a dream, and she wondered how she would get him out of the explorer if he didn't revive soon. She tried talking to him and shaking him gently, but she wasn't able to get a response from him. He was already damp and shivering, so there was no point in scooping a handful of water off the floor and splashing his face. His injuries needed to be treated as soon as possible, but that was not the primary reason that she was anxious to get him into the rover and away from there. Dangerous people were searching for him. With their resources, even hampered by weather and terrain, they would find him if she didn't quickly move him to a secure place. Grant solved her dilemma not merely by regaining consciousness, but by virtually exploding out of his unnatural sleep. With a gasp and a wordless cry, he bolted upright in his seat, bathed in a sudden sweat, yet shuddering so furiously that his teeth chattered. He was face to face with her, inches away, and even in the poor light she saw the horror in his eyes. Worse, there was a bleakness that transmitted his chill deep into her own heart. He spoke urgently, though exhaustion and thirst had reduced his voice to a coarse whisper. "Nobody knows." "It's all right," she said.
Nobody knows."
"Easy, you'll be okay."
"Nobody knows," he insisted,
and he seemed to be caught between fear and grief, between terror and tears. A terrible hopelessness informed his tortured voice and every aspect of his face to such an extent that she was struck speechless. It seemed foolish to continue to repeat meaningless reassurances to a man who appeared to have been granted a vision of the cankerous souls in Hades. Though he looked into her eyes, Spencer seemed to be gazing at someone or something far away, and he was speaking in a rush of words more to himself than to her.
"It's a chain, iron chain. It runs through me, through my brain, my heart, through my guts. A chain, no way to get loose, no escape."
He was scaring her. She hadn't thought that she could be scared anymore, at least not easily, certainly not with mere words, but he was scaring her witless.
"Come on, Spencer," she said. "Let's go, okay? Help me get you out of here."
When the slightly chubby, twinkle-eyed man stepped out of the elevator with Bobby Dubois into the windowless sub-basement, he halted in his tracks and gazed at Eve as a starving man might have stared at a bowl of peaches and cream. Eve Jammer was accustomed to having a powerful effect on men. When she had been a topless showgirl on the Las Vegas stage, she had been one beauty among many, yet the eyes of all the men had followed her, nearly to the exclusion of the other women, as though something about her face and body was not just more appealing to the eye, but so harmonious that it was like a secret siren song. She drew men's eyes to herself as inevitably as a skillful hypnotist could capture a subject's mind by swinging a gold medallion on a chain, or simply with the sinuous movements of his hands. Even poor little Thurman Stookey, the dentist who'd had the bad luck to be in the same hotel elevator with the two gorillas from whom Eve had taken the million in cash, had been vulnerable to her charms at a time when he should have been too terrified to entertain the slightest thought of sex. With the two goons dead on the elevator floor and the Cor 38 pointed at his face, Stookey had let his eyes drift from the bore of the revolver to the lush cleavage revealed by Eve's low-cut sweater. Judging by the glimmer that had come into his myopic eyes just as she'd squeezed the trigger, Eve figured that the dentist's final thought had not been, "God help me," but, "What a set!" No man had ever affected Eve to even a small fraction of the extent to which she affected most men. Indeed, she could take or leave most men. Her interest was drawn only to those from whom she might extract money, or from whom she might learn the tricks of obtaining and holding on to power. Her ultimate goal was to be extremely rich and feared, not loved. Being an object of fear, totally in control, having the power of life and death over others, that was infinitely more erotic than any man's body or lovemaking skills could ever be. Still, when she was introduced to Roy Muro, she felt something unusual, a flutter of the heart, a mild disorientation that was not in the least unpleasant. What she was feeling couldn't have been called desire. Eve's desires were all exhaustively mapped and labeled, and the periodic satisfaction of each was achieved with mathematical calculation, to a schedule as precise as that kept by a fascist train conductor. She had no time or patience for spontaneity in either business or personal affairs. The intrusion of unplanned passion would have been as repulsive to her as being forced to eat worms. Undeniably, however, she felt something from the first moment she saw Roy Miro. And minute by minute, as they discussed the Grant Davidowitz tape and then listened to it, her peculiar interest in him increased. An unfamiliar thrill of anticipation coursed through her as she wondered where events were leading. For the life of her, she couldn't figure out what qualities of the man inspired her fascination. He was rather pleasant-looking, with merry blue eyes, a choir-boy face, and a sweet smile. But he was not handsome, in the usual sense of the word. He was 15 pounds overweight, somewhat pale, and he didn't appear to be rich. He dressed with less flair than any Nazarene passing out religious publications door to door. Frequently, Miro asked her to replay a passage of the Grant Davidowitz recording as though it contained a clue that required pondering, but she knew that he had become preoccupied with her and had missed something. For both Eve and Miro, Bobby Dubois pretty much ceased to exist. In spite of his height and physical awkwardness, in spite of his colorful and ceaseless chatter, Dubois was of no more interest to either of them than were the bunker's plain concrete walls. When everything on the recording had been played and replayed, Miro went through some shuffle and jive to the effect that he was unable to do anything about Grant for the time being except wait. Wait for him to surface, wait for the skies to clear so a satellite search could begin, wait for search teams already in the field to turn up something, wait for agents investigating other aspects of the case in other cities to get back to him. Then he asked Eve if she was free for dinner. She accepted the invitation with an uncharacteristic lack of coyness. She had a growing sense that what she responded to in the man was some secret power that he possessed, a strength that was mostly hidden, and that could be glimpsed only in the self-confidence of his easy smile, and in those blue eyes that never revealed anything but amusement, as if this man expected always to have the last laugh. Although Miro had been assigned a car from the agency pool while he was in Vegas, he rode in her own Honda to a favorite restaurant of hers on Flamingo Road. Reflections of a sea of neon rolled in tidal patterns across low clouds, and the night seemed filled with magic. She expected to get to know him better over dinner and a couple of glasses of wine, and to understand by dessert why he fascinated her. However, his skills as a conversationalist were equivalent to his looks, pleasant enough, but far from beguiling. Nothing that Miro said, nothing that he did, no gesture, no look, brought Eve any closer to understanding the curious attraction that he held for her. By the time they left the restaurant and crossed the parking lot toward her car, she was frustrated and confused. She didn't know whether she should invite him back to her place or not. She didn't want sex with him. It wasn't that kind of attraction, really. Of course, some men revealed their truest selves when they had sex, by what they liked to do, by how they did it, by what they said and how they acted, both during and after. But she didn't want to take him home, do it with him, get all sweaty, go the whole disgusting route, and still not understand what it was about him that so intrigued her. She was in a dilemma. Then, as they drew near to her car, with the cold wind soughing in a nearby row of palm trees and the air scented with the aroma of charcoal-broiled steaks from the restaurant, Roy Miro did the most unexpected and outrageous thing that Eve had ever seen in 33 years of outrageous experience. An immeasurable time after getting down from the Explorer and into the Range Rover, which could have been an hour or 2 minutes or 30 days and 30 nights for all he knew, Spencer woke and saw a herd of tumbleweed pacing them. The shadows of mesquite and paddle-leaf cactus leapt through the headlights. He rolled his head to the left against the back of the seat and saw Valerie behind the wheel.
Hi.
Hi there.
How'd you get here?
That's too complicated for you right now.
I'm a complicated guy.
I don't doubt it.
Where are we going?
Away.
Good.
How are you feeling?
Woozy.
Don't pee on the seat, she said with obvious amusement. He said,
I'll try not to.
Good.
Where's my dog?
Who do you think's licking your ear?
Oh.
He's right there behind you.
Hi, pal.
What's his name? She asked.
Rocky.
You gotta be kidding.
About what?
The name doesn't fit.
I named him that so he'd have more confidence.
Isn't working, she said. Strange rock formations loomed, like temples to gods forgotten before human beings had been capable of conceiving the idea of time and counting the passage of days. They awed him, and she drove among them with great expertise, whipping left and right down a long hill onto a vast, dark flatness.
Never knew his real name, Spencer said.
Real name?
Puppy name, before the pound.
Wasn't Rocky.
Probably not.
What was it before Spencer?
He was never named Spencer.
So you're clear-headed enough to be evasive.
Not really, just habit. What's your name?
Valerie Keane.
Liar.
He went away for a while. When he came round again, there was still desert, sand and stone, scrub and tumbleweed, darkness pierced by headlights.
Valerie?
He said. Yeah?
What's your real name?
Bess.
Bess what?
Bess Bear.
Spell it.
B-A-E-R.
Really?
Really? For now?
What's that mean?
It means what it means.
It means that's your name now, after Valerie.
So?
What was your name before Valerie?
Hannah Rainey.
Oh, yeah,
he said, realizing that he was firing on only 4 of 6 cylinders.
Before that?
Gina DeLuccio.
Was that real?
It felt real.
Is that the name you were born with?
You mean my puppy name?
Yeah, that's your puppy name?
Nobody's called me by my puppy name since before I was in the pound, she said.
You're very funny.
You like funny women?
I must.
And then the funny woman, she said, as if reading from a printed page, and the cowardly dog and the mysterious man rode off into the desert in search of their real names.
In search of a place to puke?
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
She applied the brakes and he flung open the door. Later, when he woke, still riding through the dark desert, he said,
I have the most god-awful taste in my mouth.
I don't doubt it.
What's your name?
Bess.
Bullshit.
No, Bear. Bess Bear. What's your name?
My faithful Indian sidekick calls me Kimosabe.
How do you feel?
Like shit, he said.
Well, that's what Kimosabe means.
Are we ever going to stop?
Not while we have cloud cover.
What have clouds got to do with anything?
Satellites, she said.
You are the strangest woman I've ever known.
Just wait.
How the hell did you find me?
Maybe I'm psychic.
Are you psychic?
No. He sighed and closed his eyes. He could almost imagine that he was on a merry-go-round.
I was supposed to find you.
Surprise.
I wanted to help you.
Thanks. He let go of his grip on the world of the waking. For a while, all was silent and serene. Then he walked out of the darkness and opened the red door. There were rats in the catacombs. Roy did a crazy thing. Even as he was doing it, he was amazed at the risk he was taking. He decided that he should be himself in front of Eve Jammer, his real self, his deeply committed, compassionate, caring self that was never more than half revealed in the bland, bureaucratic functionary that he appeared to be to most people. Roy was willing to take risks with this stunning woman because he sensed that her mind was as marvelous as her ravishing face and body. The woman within, so close to emotional and intellectual perfection, would understand him as no one else ever had.